WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Karl Rove has long been one of President Bush's closest advisors. Rove has influenced some of the president's most controversial decisions. With Rove, politics drives policy. This hour, who is Karl Rove? And is he the most powerful person never elected? First, a new report out of Washington Today is taking aim at foreign governments that support terrorism. The State Department has named Iran, Sudan, Libya, Iraq, North Korea, Cuba, and Syria as state sponsors of terrorism. Alan Cyprys is a reporter with The Washington Post and was at Secretary Powell's briefing today. I asked him why these seven countries were singled out.
All seven of those countries have been on the list for a number of years now.
Mm-hmm.
What's most noteworthy about the list is how constant it remains from year to year. In asking about Libya and Sudan, what was notable this year was that the State Department said that both those countries had been taking steps to distance themselves from terrorism and cooperate in the U.S. effort against terrorism.
Did it detail what the steps were?
Yes, it does. With regards to Libya, it says Libya had announced the September 11th attacks and has been consistently critical of terrorist organizations, terrorist attacks, and has now assumed what the State Department says is a role as a peacemaker. At least Libya is seeking to become a peacemaker in a number of regional disputes. The problem for Libya is some attacks that it's allegedly been involved in the past, including the downing of Pan Am 103 in 1988. And there are a number of requirements that have been imposed by the UN Security Council, such as paying appropriate compensation to the families of the victims, acknowledging guilt and disclosing all it knows about the attack before Libya can get off the list.
Cuba is on the list.
That's right. What it says about Cuba is that it continues to have connections with a number of suspected militants and terrorists. It points to Colombians. It points to Basque separatists who have been living there for some time.
And the axis of evil is there, Iran, Iraq, and North Korea.
That's right.
What does it say about those countries?
Iran and North Korea, the State Department puts into a category, along with Syria, says these three countries have been sending mixed signals, that both of them have taken some modest steps to cooperate in the effort against terrorism. And in the case of Syria, that includes intelligence cooperation. In case of Iran, there was some cooperation during the military campaign in Afghanistan. At the same time, the U.S. is faulting both Iran and Syria for continuing to provide bases or headquarters for a number of groups that the administration considers to be terrorists, such as Hamas and Hezbollah. In the case of North Korea, they say that North Korea started to make some progress and abruptly stopped.
And Iraq?
Well, there's more in the report about Iraq than there was in the past. Essentially, what they say is there's a number of terrorist groups, groups that seem to be fairly inactive these days, but that continue to have some connections or headquarters in Baghdad. The report also says they've looked into the connection between al-Qaeda and Iraq, in particular a meeting that may have taken place between Mohammed Atta and Iraqi intelligence in Prague, and they do not find any conclusive link, not at this point.
To the September 11th bombings.
That's right.
So Iraq, they don't charge Iraq with connection to that.
None of these seven countries have been linked to al-Qaeda or to the September 11th attacks.
Were there any surprises in this report?
No, not really. Maybe what's surprising about it is that given that there's so much attention being given to terrorism, the war on terrorism now, the report really reads a lot like the reports in previous years. I mean, there's much more about the steps the U.S. has been taking. And for just about every government in the world, the U.S. comments, the State Department has a commentary on how well they're cooperating in the war on terrorism. But essentially, the seven countries are the same seven countries, and the allegations that were made against them last year and the year before are largely the same ones that are in the report this year.
Even though the difference between last year and this year is that the war on terror.
Right. So the American effort and the international effort may have been stepped up. But the kind of concerns about these countries have remained fairly constant. Now, of course, there's been a major change in the landscape, and that is what's happened in Afghanistan.
Yes, the end of the Taliban, and last year, presumably, Afghanistan was on the list.
Well, no, it wasn't. Afghanistan has never been listed as one of the state sponsors of terrorism, and the explanation that the folks at state give is that the U.S. never recognized the Taliban government of Afghanistan as a legitimate state, so it couldn't be a state sponsor.
I see. Secretary Powell briefed reporters on this. He seemed to applaud the progress that had been made.
most of his attention has been on the overall international effort.
Mm-hmm.
Powell and others in the administration point to, first, the gains in the military campaign in Afghanistan. They point to the diplomatic progress that's been made in building an international coalition,
mm-hmm.
some of the efforts to choke off financial flows to Al-Qaeda and other groups, increased intelligence sharing and so forth. Now, that has had an impact on a couple of the state sponsors, again, in particular Sudan, which has really been quite helpful, we're told,
mm-hmm.
in the effort against Al-Qaeda. And Libya, there's been some progress there. But Powell was largely speaking about the overall international effort.
And he was encouraged.
He certainly seemed to be.
And this is on the same week that we've been hearing the possibilities of terror here as discouraging.
That's right. No one in the State Department, certainly not Secretary Powell nor anyone else at the Department, is saying that the progress that is being made will rule out attacks in the future.
Mm-hmm.
What they're saying, though, is that if the risk is serious now, well, if the U.S. hadn't undertaken these efforts, the risk would be even greater.
Alan, thank you very much.
Glad to join you.
Alan Tsipras is a reporter with The Washington Post. Karl Rove is a master of the art of politics. Opponents fear him. Allies praise his acumen. All acknowledge his power in this current administration. With the departure of Karen Hughes, Rove, who occupies Hillary Clinton's old office in the White House, has a monopoly on the president's ear. Always a key player in setting domestic policy, Rove is now turfing on foreign policy. Listeners, sate your curiosity, share your suspicions about this behind-the-scenes political maven. What role should political consultants Rove, Dick Morris, play in shaping public policy? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from his home in Austin, Texas, is Paul Berker, a political writer for Texas Monthly Magazine and longtime observer of Karl Rove. Welcome, Paul Berker.
Well, thank you. Hello there.
Hello to you. Paul, bring us up to date. Who is Karl Rove? Take us to the point where he meets George W. Bush, the sort of short biography of Karl Rove.
Well, he was a political consultant in Texas. He did direct mail. He was an outsider for many years because Texas was a Democratic state right up until the time that George W. Bush won the governorship in 1994 by defeating Ann Richards. He lost a lot of races just because Republicans lost races and won a few. But in 1990, he broke through with the election, a couple of elections, and including Kay Bailey Hutchison, to a major office, which she used as a springboard to the Senate. And he had worked for George Bush, or as they call him in the White House, 41, you know, the 41st president, the 43rd.
Mm-hmm.
43rd. So he worked for 41. And in around 1990, he picked out George W. Bush as somebody who could be a potential breakthrough candidate for the Republicans, somebody who could lead them to a majority. And he worked on him for a long time, and finally he persuaded him to run in 1994. And, of course, he was a big underdog to Ann Richards, but he ran a very good race. Richards' heart really wasn't in her reelection, and she didn't run a very good race, and Bush defeated her, and then that catapulted Rove to prominence. And because Bush was so strong, Rove was the de facto Republican Party chairman, although that wasn't his title. He remained a consultant.
Mm-hmm.
But he had the ear of all the big donors in
mm-hmm.
Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And so he could determine who could run for what office. He would handpick people.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically ran the Republican Party. And also he has total knowledge of the party in all the other states because he's run races in other states. And
mm-hmm.
so he just became an enormous power in Republican circles and here and nationally, and I think most of all He works about 26 hours a day.
Yeah, you mentioned that in an article you wrote for the Texas Monthly. Let's just go back to that 1994 campaign, Bush's first campaign for governor in Texas.
Right.
As you know, that was a point where Karl Rove's sharp elbows came into play. He was charged with spreading a rumor that former Texas Governor Ann Richards was too tolerant of gays and lesbians. True?
Well, it's true that he was charged, and certainly that the Republicans had a whispering campaign. East Texas is really part of the South. When you get up there in the woods, in the Piney Woods, and they pretty much stop on the highway from Dallas down to Houston, you get east of that, and it's Gothic back there. It's Mississippi. And so homosexuals, anti-guns, Richard had vetoed a referendum for being able to have a right to carry bill. And so those things were definitely part of the whispering campaign in East Texas. Now, whether, you know, I mean, I don't know if Rove did it, but I certainly think that he would have thought of it. And that's just, you know, that's just the way politics is.
Especially Texas politics, which is a serious business.
And it's going on right now, and, I mean, we have our governor's race coming up, and so there are whispers again.
Yes, yes. Let's get him back to so he talks Bush into, and Bush was reluctant to run for governor.
I think Bush was a little reluctant to run. He really had not been in the public eye ever. His wife is, as we know, very shy about the public limelight. He had thought about running in 90. Rove, at least, had suggested that he run in 90. And the White House, which, of course, 41 was in the White House, they didn't want him to run because the president's prestige would be at stake on how his son did. And then his mother didn't think he was ready, and he probably wasn't. And he did a lot of work between 90 and 94 and got up to speed on it's not the hardest job in the world. We have a weak governor system. It's surprisingly weak. My son was taking high school government this year, and he was looking for powers of the governor, and, well, there just aren't any. You know, basically what they do is they make appointments to boards and commissions which run the government but are not subject to the governor. And so pretty much what you do is based on how popular you are, and as a result, Bush won the election. He ran a very good race. They picked issues that were certain to be successful because they were already being studied by the legislature. And then, and this is more Karen Hughes than Rove, Bush stayed on message always. Four things. There were four things he wanted, and they were, you know, tort reform and juvenile justice and welfare reform, that and education reform. And people would ask him, well, what's the fifth thing? And he said, pass the first four things. And that's kind of pure Karen. But I think Rove began to be perceived as a genius by the success of that race. And
because, after all, Ann Richards was a sitting governor.
Ann Richards was a sitting governor, and she was extremely popular. And the exit polls, I was talking to somebody the other day, the exit polls on the day of the race, people would ask, do you like Ann Richards? Oh, yeah, I'm crazy about her. Who'd you vote for? Bush. So her popularity stayed up way above 60%, but Bush was almost a cult figure from the very beginning here. And I think he's much, much more Texan than his father. Of course, we think a lot of people down here think of his father as a Yankee. I hate to use those words on your radio stations, but, you know, he is from the
God help us, Connecticut.
Yeah, that state is Connie something or other. And so, you know, he's we think of him as being from up there, but Bush went to school here, grew up in Midland, which is in the desert. And he's, you know, he was He was also owner of the Texas Rangers.
Which matters. We're going to come right back. We're going to come right back to you. We're talking about the mystery man of the Bush administration, Karl Rove, this hour. And we're asking, what role should political consultants like Karl Rove, like Dick Morris, play in shaping public policy? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
From Boston University.
I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're shedding light on Karl Rove this hour, the Mark Hanna of the Bush administration. Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Paul Berker of the Texas Monthly. We're talking to Paul. Paul, David Shribman of the Boston Globe, covering the Bush campaigns of 94 and 98, he asked, is there a place where George W. Bush ends and Karl Rove begins? Is that a fair statement of how the Rove-Bush relationship seemed in Texas?
I always thought that Bush had a healthy skepticism about Rove, to tell you the truth, mm-hmm. that there were stories that the third member of the trio, in addition to Bush and in addition to Rove and Karen Hughes, was a man named Joe Albaugh, who was the chief of staff here in the governor's office, and he and Rove quarreled frequently because Rove was kind of a loose lips sink ships guy.
Mm-hmm.
He would let slip that Bush was planning to run for the president 6 months before Karen Hughes wanted to announce it, and he got his name in the paper a lot. And Bush doesn't like that. He doesn't like to see his aides.
Mm-hmm.
He demands, he doesn't like that.
Yeah.
There was one story that made the rounds that Rove got a cell phone call during a meeting with Bush and went outside, and they locked the door on him.
For having the chutzpah to take his
yeah.
phone call during his meeting with the governor.
I mean, Bush is very jealous of his prerogative.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean that he's, he once, told a member of his staff, thou shalt not argue with thy governor. And the idea, at least in Texas, that he was some sort of puppet of Rove, mm-hmm. I think is completely wrong. But Rove was outside the governor's office.
Sure.
He was in his business office,
yeah.
which was, 8 or 10 blocks away.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't come over that much and was pretty much out of substance.
Yeah.
And I think that was healthy.
We only have her for a few minutes, Paul. So let's turn to Eleanor Clift. She's a political commentator and writer for Newsweek magazine. Eleanor Clift, welcome.
Glad to be with you. Hi.
Hi. Well, we've been talking about the Texas years of Karl Rove. Where are the Rove fingerprints on domestic and foreign policy today? Where do we see his influence?
Well, I think they're visible on some things, and the assumption is that his fingerprints are on everything. I mean, he, lives inside the White House, and you kind of imagine him dashing down and into the Oval Office. He has the small office on the second floor that used to belong to Hillary Clinton. And, I think there is this myth, which I assume is substantively true, that there isn't anything that happens in that White House that Karl Rove doesn't know about, doesn't have input on, doesn't influence to some extent.
Mm. There was a front page piece in the New York Times a week ago or 2 weeks ago that says that his role is a subject of growing discussion in the State Department, the Pentagon, the Trade Office, and other areas, that he's moving into foreign policy.
Well, I think even political consultants themselves get nervous when they venture into foreign policy, because the tradition has been that partisanship, stops at the water's edge. Now, that's really not true anymore, but I think for the most part, consultants have taken pains not to be visibly linked to foreign policy. But the word in Washington is that, Karl Rove thinks that any kind of venture into Iraq would be too risky in this election year. And so I think there are lots of other reasons for not going into Iraq, and I think the administration is unlikely to be able to mount any kind of offensive before November. But you can be sure that people are going to attribute that partly to Rove's voice. And the fact that his voice is heard at all, I think, sets a new standard for this White House in terms of its reliance on a political consultant. Again, inside the White House, I heard the other speaker before me,
Paul Burka,
that in Texas, Karl Rove was outside of the White House. Well, Dick Morris also was outside of the White House in the Jefferson Hotel, just a few blocks away. But,
but don't we know that?
He's on the payroll again. You know, just escalates this.
The steel tariff decision that had West Virginia and Pennsylvania electoral votes written all over it.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, if you watch the president's travel, he goes to the battleground states. It's been a very politically calculated, you know, targeted administration from a political standpoint ever since they took office. And Rove is willing to anger the conservative stalwarts on some of these issues when he thinks there's a bigger prize at play, like the electoral votes of a state. And yet then there are moments where you get the feeling that he does something specifically for the right-wing base. I mean, arguing that gun rights have to be redefined as individual rights seemed to a lot of people here in Washington an unnecessary thing to do, but something that very much pleases, you know, the NRA and a lot of the president's base. And so you can find those issues, too, that seem to have Rove's fingerprints on them.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about his fingerprints on this year's congressional elections?
Well, he, a couple of months ago, was caught saying to Republicans that they could run on the war and that they should be proud of how the president has prosecuted the war. Now, obviously, they would be doing that, but that's an issue that's best left unsaid, and I think he's really gotten some heat for that.
Perhaps some heat from President Bush.
Well, yes, and then now that some questions are being raised about, you know, whether the president did, whether this administration did all they could leading up to the September 11, I think has tarnished the war a bit as a political issue. But I think, you know, Rove is very much identified with an attempt to politically exploit the war, which, you know, again, it's something that you would expect that they would do, but would do with some more subtlety. I think that's one area where he's kind of has fumbled.
The Bush administration has been taking sides in Republican primaries in several places. Is this part of the Rove policy?
I think it's not only Rove. I think Dick Cheney weighs in on this one, too.
Mm-hmm.
I think they very much want to win back the Senate, and they also understand that they need to keep some of those governor's offices Republican to help out in 2004. And so they've been quite openly aggressive about recruiting candidates, moving other candidates aside, and in some cases that's backfired. You know, local folks don't like to be told what to do, and so that clearly backfired in California, where they got the wrong nominee governor. But nonetheless, they are intricately involved. I wouldn't be surprised if they were, you know, working mayor's races on the side. I mean, they really would like to, you know, get as many of their friends in office as possible. I mean, this is an administration where political friends and political loyalty just counts for so much. It's extraordinary. It is almost like a cult. Again, I heard Paul mention the word cult, that Bush was almost a cult figure. Well, the people around him are almost a cult in their devotion and their loyalty.
Speaking of that, what is the sort of inside skinny on Karen Hughes's departure vis-a-vis Karl Rove?
Well, there have been stories about them battling, and I'm sure they do. They're both strong-willed people, but I don't believe for a minute that he drove her out. I mean, I guess as a woman, I really empathize with her trying to transplant a teenager from a Texas public school to a snooty private school in Washington. That was her first mistake. And a husband who clearly didn't really resettle. So, I mean, I really believe her when she says it's mostly personal. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if she ends up on the plane in 2004. I think she'll be back in this president's life.
Mm. Paul Burka, is that your sense of the Karen Hughes departure as well?
Yes, it is. I wrote about that this month in Texas Monthly. But I do think that Karen's area of message at the same time has become less crucial and has been supplanted by politics. Mm. So I think the inner voice that said it's time to leave for my family probably also said that there's not that much I can do here with foreign policy and war being on the table and message really having to give way to ad hoc political considerations for, both overseas and at home.
Message discipline was her forte.
Yeah, you just can't do it when you've got to decide what, you know,
right.
what do you want to do with the Israelis here.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
I just don't think it's possible. But I think it's inconceivable to me that Rove could have forced Karen out. In fact, I think this is a small disaster, a small emotional disaster for the president, that he is so dependent upon Hughes as the person that he can sit back and talk to completely frankly. And Karen told me before she went up there, Washington's values aren't my values.
Mm.
And I think that's just true. She was not. I think she was always a part-time, although completely loyal, political player. And I just don't think she wanted the kind of all-out spin, constant, permanent campaign that Washington offered. I don't think that went with her either. But all of those things, I think, made her ready to. To come home.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But she will. Eleanor's...
Sorry?
Hello?
Yeah.
Eleanor's completely right that she has committed to travel with him from Labor Day in 2004 to the election.
So she will be around. We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We're botanizing on Karl Rove. Jim is on the line. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Well, just fine, thank you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Your question.
Well, I just, it was actually more of a comment.
Okay.
It was something that I struck me very strongly. I've in the past, I've attended a conference in Washington given by Evans and Novak.
Mm-hmm.
And when Dole was running, I heard his, what I presume was his campaign director, some high-ranking person, and he was awful. His first and winning strategy related to, you know, how many judges they were, you know, about to appoint or something. And it was, everyone was looking around the room bewildered that, you know, this is how he's going to win the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
Years later, prior to Bush's election, I saw Rove for the first time. I'd never heard of him.
Mm-hmm.
And I was blown away. He was absolutely, he was incredibly sharp. He was knowledgeable. He could drill down on just about anything. Very bright. So I'm just struck that I think someone mentioned earlier, you know, the crispness of the message, and I suppose by implication, you know, is there anything wrong with having a guy like that in the background? And I guess my opinion is no. I think it's great.
Okay.
Take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Eleanor Cliff, Karl Rove, a very, very, very well-versed in American political history, isn't he? Sort of self-taught fellow, isn't he?
That's right. I mean, he didn't have, you know, an illustrious education. He was a voracious reader with an interest in American history. He does bring a perspective to this president and, you know, sees him in the grand sweep of things. You know, I don't think there's anything wrong with having a Karl Rove around, but I think the role that he plays is evident of the importance this administration, you know, places on politics and ensuring the reelection of this president. And, you know, others have done it. I think President Clinton took a lot of heat for being too concerned with politics. The genius of Rove, or maybe it's the genius of George W. Bush, is that the public doesn't really see him as political an animal as he is.
Mm.
And maybe that's because of 9/11, but, you know, I think he's been mythologized to some extent by the war and how he was able to seem to be on top of it. Now, whether that will continue to 2004, I don't know. You can get different arguments in Washington. Some think he has bonded in a way with the American people that is unshakable. Others think that the relationship is far more fragile. I think I'd probably put myself in the latter camp, but I'm not certain about that either.
What about 2004? Are there already senses in the White House that he's shaping strategy, Karl Rove is, for 2004?
Oh, yeah. I mean, everything from the travel schedule to the determination to return to some domestic themes so the Democrats can't trump him on that, to the continuing paranoia about any potential threat that a John McCain might pose. Oh, I think, yeah, they're highly aware of an election, which is really not that far away because, you know, on the Democratic side, the primaries will start almost immediately after New Year's on January 2003, and the jockeying among Democrats has already begun. And the fact that there are so many out there willing to take him on, wanting to take him on, I think makes the White House wonder if the Democrats know something they don't.
You mentioned John McCain. Paul Burka, in a recent article in The Nation, a Texas writer says that John McCain, there's no love lost with Karl Rove, and that allegations have been made that Rove circulated rumors. Again, this is naive even to put it this way, but I suppose that's how it works. That John McCain, that his Vietnam experience had rendered him unstable.
Well, first of all, any rumor is going to be, we learned this in Texas, it's going to be attributed to Rove. He is always considered to be the man behind any strategy. So the fact that it's attributed to me is just standard business. There's no one else that comes anywhere close to being involved in strategy. I think the a lot of the bitterness between Bush and Rove was that between Bush and McCain is that their consultants, Rove and then from McCain, John Weaver, were old rivals in Texas with great bitterness, and Weaver believes that Rove drove him out of the Republican Party, that there was tremendous personal gossip in that race directed at, in the fight directed at Weaver, who now has left McCain and gone over to the Democrats. And then Weaver was had been a head of the Republican Party, and they'd been friends. So a lot of that bitterness, the two campaigns really hated each other. It wasn't just the people at the top, and they didn't like each other either.
And that was apparent in the debates.
Yeah, absolutely. It was just, you know, Bush felt that McCain was, had, first of all, he got beat by him. He got beat by him by 18 points, and Bush doesn't like to get beat. But they also felt he was winning with non-Republicans, and they just didn't like him.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't have to give him any reason. It's gut and instinct.
That's for sure. Eleanor Cliff, we're going to lose you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again. Join us again, please. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We'll be right back. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're trying to shed light on Karl Rove, the master of politics in the White House this hour. Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Paul Burka of the Texas Monthly, and now with Stuart Stevens, former chief political consultant for the Bush presidential campaign. Mr. Stevens now heads his own political consulting firm. Welcome, Stuart Stevens.
Well, thank you very much. I'd have to correct that. I would really consider Karl Rove far and away the chief political consultant for the Bush campaign. I was a lowly foot soldier trying to make some television commercials.
Well, put us inside Karl Rove's busy brain.
Oh, what a scary thought.
Yeah, right. You know, looking out at the political world, What, if we looked at it through his eyes, mm-hmm. what would we see? What would look to him like President Bush's prospects, and what would look like the risks? I mean, give us the Karl Rove worldview.
That's an interesting question. You know, Karl has this, I think, unique ability that I've ever, more so than anybody I've ever seen in politics, to think up close and far away at the same time.
Up close and far away.
Yeah. He really can... Some of us consider ourselves very lucky if we can do either one of those.
Mm-hmm.
He can do both simultaneously, sort of in a three-dimensional chess way. I think that probably, for instance, the latest little flap over what the president knew or didn't know doesn't worry Karl at all. This is just, I haven't told him about it. It's just sheer assumption on my part.
Mm-hmm.
He knows that basically if the question is national security, the answer is not going to be a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are you going to feel safer if Dick Gephardt's president? I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that to the extent that that is out there, he thinks it probably plays to the president's strength. I think that he is very pleased, as most of us are, with the ability that the public has had to see the president perform. And this was a great frustration we had in the campaign, and those of us making television commercials, Mark McKinnon and myself, we often felt that we never really did a good job capturing the Governor Bush that we saw.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this crisis has given the public a chance to see more of the qualities that we saw in him.
And what would those be?
Qualities of leadership, basically, a
mm-hmm.
steadiness,
mm-hmm.
An ability to not second-guess himself,
mm-hmm.
An ability to sort of analyze a situation and try to get to the heart of it and make the right decision,
mm-hmm.
and a sort of optimism.
Mm.
And he's also, you know, one of his leadership qualities is that he's very loyal.
Bush to his aides.
Yeah, and to those that he has decided to trust to make decisions. And, you know, if you see the postmortems that have been written in Newsweek and the Washington Post, that long series that Dan Balz and Woodward did,
mm-hmm.
sort of analyzing what was happening, you know, when those days, in first few weeks into the Afghanistan war, when, you know, immediately the other side hadn't thrown up their hands and quit, and there was talk that the war was stagnating and our plan was wrong, and the president was very reassuring and said, no, we're going to let the plan work. It will work. And it did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we saw that same quality when we lost New Hampshire by 19 points. Not exactly.
He wasn't worried about it, and he should have been.
Well, you know, it was fascinating because, you know, he invited us in, you know, and, you know, in the back of our heads, all of us are remembering that Ronald Reagan won New Hampshire and still fired everybody.
Yeah.
And, you know, he just said, look, you know, I made mistakes. You guys sure made mistakes. But this is behind us. And
yeah, yeah. Well, we were talking about looking out through Karl Rove's eyes at the president's prospects, and you say that national security is going to work to his advantage. What are the risks that Karl Rove would see out there and would be telling George Bush about?
Oh, I think, you know, the economy is obviously a risk for every president. And there's just a limit to how much you can impact a business cycle. One of the sort of confounding realities of the 2000 election was on the day of the election, consumer confidence was at an all-time high that since it's been tracked on elections. That's the sort of environment in which an incumbent party should be reelected. If you have a combination, I think, of a bad economy and a stage in this ongoing war on terrorism that doesn't seem to be going well, and that there's going to be good days and bad mm-hmm. days and good mm-hmm. stages and bad stages, mm-hmm. that could be a very troubling combination.
Right. Right.
And then there's really not much, if you're a guy like Karl Rove, there's really not much you can do about that.
Yeah,
because I can promise you the president is going to execute this war as he sees best and is not going to be worried about the politics of it.
Even though Rove has been quoted as saying the congressional candidates should make use of the politics of it. Perhaps.
Yeah, I got to say, I thought the Democrats' crocodile tears over that was absolutely hysterical. You know, of course you could talk about how the president's doing a good job. I mean, it's such a sort of truism.
Mm-hmm.
And they throw up their arms and go, oh, my gosh, we can't talk about that, you
yeah.
know. And you know, of course, here when you know doubts are raised about whether or not there was adequate communication and whatnot, which I think is a fair question to raise.
Yeah.
That's fair game.
Yeah.
So of course, look, I mean,
sure.
you talk about your performance as president. A lot of what his performance is the execution of the war on terror.
Paul Burka, sort of a binocular mind attributed here to Karl Rove. He's up; he can look up close and far away at the same time. In your dealings with him, you see that, and how would that manifest itself?
Oh, it was amazing. I asked Karl for to at the start of the year of 2000, or it was really the fall. How does Bush go about winning the presidency?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, what do you do in the primary? And he laid it out. There were four separate primaries. There was a money primary. There was a leadership primary. In his mind, all before New Hampshire started, that he had to go through. There was an ideas primary, and then he already knew where Bush was going to be every day of that year to the end of the year, to election day, a year out. He had a schedule. Now, he was ready to change the schedule, but he had it. It was already there. So he thinks strategically, long-term, and he definitely thinks short-term, how do I get this done? And he works indefatigably. I mean, he just is – he's one of these people that – I'm not one of them, but he can get, you know, 26 hours of work done in a 24-hour day. He answers everybody's emails. He's just he's phenomenal like that. I do think he is just a very smart guy about politics. He's thought about it. He has this. He always has. This race is like the 2000 race was like William McKinley in 1896, and he has a whole argument for it. And you mentioned Mark Hanna. I mean, that's one of Rove's heroes, and he gave me a long riff about why Mark Hanna gets a bad rap in history. Well, it's because Mark Hanna knew how to win elections, you know, and he knew the secret. And I just think that Rove is just a really smart guy when it comes to politics. He's very gifted, and he has a great instinct for it. But you know, he's not infallible. I've seen him make mistakes and get on the wrong side of Bush on occasion, and certainly have it out pretty good with Karen on occasion. So
yeah.
I mean, there's no question about that, because politics poaches on message. There's no question, and I think that it has more so in Washington than it did in Austin.
Well, Paul Burka, thank you, and Stuart Stevens, thank you. You've both given us a new light on Karl Rove. Paul Burka is a political writer for the Texas Monthly magazine. Stuart Stevens is the former political consultant for the Bush presidential campaign. Continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a Kenyan scientist returns to Africa to fight AIDS. This is On Point. Scientist at Harvard University School of Public Health, Kenyan researcher Thumbi Indongo is on the front line in the fight against AIDS. This summer, he's going to Botswana to set up clinical trials for an AIDS vaccine. In this diary, he talks about watching AIDS devastate his home country of Kenya and how he hopes to apply what he's learned in the U.S. to help the people of Africa.
When I left Kenya in the mid-1990s, HIV was not a very visible problem. It was not very easy to tell that very many people are infected. HIV/AIDS is not something that people, at least at that point, people didn't go around saying they were HIV infected. And in fact, very few people knew that they were HIV infected. The people who are working in laboratories by that time were beginning to realize that this is a huge problem, because physicians would refer people for testing, and the results would come out positive. But there was a general feeling that this was not a big problem, I would say, at that time. In fact, I remember when I first came here in 1995, people would ask me about how serious the problem of HIV and AIDS was in Kenya, and I would kind of get angry about it because I felt like these people are just associating my country with a terrible problem, and yet it's not such a big problem. And I'll kind of get angry and kind of dismiss them. But I think the situation had changed by the time I went back to Kenya, in fact, only 3 years later. And by that time, people in my village could point to people that I knew that had actually died of HIV, AIDS, or were actually infected. I would say that the situation changed within a very short period of time, from one where people didn't really take it as a very serious problem to a time where they actually realized that this was, in fact, a very serious problem. Every time when you come across a problem like HIV and AIDS, especially for me, that affects people that are known to you, of course it has some impact. And you feel some responsibility toward those people. I would go back home and everybody would ask me, so what are you studying at Harvard or in the United States? And I would say I'm working on HIV vaccine development. And everybody would say, that's exactly what we need here. So when I went back in 1998, I came back here feeling tremendous pressure and feeling tremendous weight of responsibility to try and contribute something. I work at the Harvard School of Public Health in the Department of Immunology and Infectious Diseases. And my research has basically focused on developing a vaccine that is relevant for strains of HIV that are prevalent or that are very common in sub-Saharan Africa. So I'll be leaving Harvard in the United States at the end of next month, which is June, and going to Botswana. And I'm going to be working in a trial to try and see whether a vaccine that is developed in the laboratory can actually protect people from getting infected with HIV and AIDS. I'm also going there to try and set up a laboratory, trying to characterize the viruses that are common in Southern Africa, to try and understand those viruses better, try and understand how they're changing, and try and understand what we need to understand before we can actually develop a vaccine or even new therapeutic agents that may be useful in these populations. HIV/AIDS has completely devastated the African continent. That's not an overstatement. It's absolutely true that unless something is done, and done quickly to turn the tide, Africa is going to be decimated by the HIV/AIDS pandemic. And so I feel like going back there to be part of a vaccine trial, it's like being part of something that is bigger than yourself. And I feel like I want to be there. I want to be in the front line. That's the reason I'm going, because I want to be in the front line. And I feel that I can make a difference.
Thambe Ndongo lives in Boston. He leaves Harvard for Botswana in June. Listeners, we'd like to hear from you. How are events in the news affecting you personally? If you have a story that would make a good radio diary, email us. The address is onpoint@wbur.org. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you.